I'm very happy now to welcome Gerald Garvey. He is a nuclear physicist at Los Alamos. He is former director of the Meson Physics Facility. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, we cannot on the radio today prove E equals MC squared because we do need blackboards and chalk or the equivalent. Is that correct?
Yep. And some figures.
Okay. Yeah. But you can take regular people who haven't studied science since high school and go through it?
I believe that's true. We're going to have to deal with some forces and things moving, but the forces are going to be no complicated than a push.
We understand those.
Yeah. And so the problem that I solve for you is two guys are standing on a cart and one throws a ball to the other guy. The guy catches it. We see how they move. And then we change the problem to a source emitting light that gets captured and analyze the problem the same way, and boom, E equals MC squared comes out.
Excellent. Well, that we'll have to do tonight. Meanwhile, I thought that since I don't have that much of an opportunity on this program to talk to nuclear physicists, I thought maybe we could talk about nuclei, about atoms and subatomic particles. Now, one of the things that I think is helpful, first of all, is when we were all in science class and we saw a hydrogen atom, it was these little balls on a page, which was basically what, a proton and a neutron?
If it's hydrogen, it's just a proton.
It's just a proton.
You bet.
And then you've got orbiting around it
an electron.
One electron.
Yeah.
Now, in real life, first of all, the scale of these things is tiny. It's 1/10 millionth of a centimeter large. But I think what people forget when they remember their, or what they don't know when they remember their high school textbooks, is that the size of the proton compared to the size of the electron is a huge difference, and the distance between them is also a huge distance.
Yeah. And in a sense, you really can't talk about the size of the electron. What you talk about is the orbit that it's running around the proton with, because the electron, as far as we know, is a point particle.
What does that mean?
Well, it doesn't really have any size that we know of or that we have been able to measure.
So, again, in our textbooks, that little circle is not really a thing with mass.
That's right. It's just a thing that has charge on it, and that's what you really sense. And, of course, it has a mass, but that mass is very light, and that's one of the things that physicists are trying to understand now, what the origin of mass is. This accelerator in Switzerland that had all this trouble, the LHC, is looking for a particle called a Higgs, and it's basically the interaction of these particles with Higgses that gives them mass. That's what we believe.
What's a Higgs?
It's named after Peter Higgs, an English physicist who came up with the idea of a scalar field that could impart. Basically, what it does is mass is a property that if you push on an object with mass, the mass resists moving. So
if you push on a block of lead, it resists moving.
Exactly.
If you push on a grain of sand, it resists moving.
But not so much as the block of lead.
And when you push on an electron, if you could do so.
Yeah. And then the thing that gives it the resistance to moving is its interaction with this Higgs field. So the Higgs field is kind of like a soup out there that kind of tries to slow things down. And there's an enormous scale of masses of these fundamental particles.
Well, I thought we could talk about some more of those fundamental particles, but let's just stay with the atom for a second. So hydrogen is a proton and electron. Then you go up the periodic table and you start adding neutrons and protons and electrons, and you get heavier and heavier atoms.
Yep.
And the weight is determined by the nucleus, which is protons and neutrons.
You betcha.
So protons are positive.
Right.
And you get a whole mess of protons stuck together. They're all positive. Why don't they blow apart?
Well, if there were just protons, they would have blown apart. In fact, you can't even stick two protons together. So what happens is the neutron comes in and really provides a lot of the binding between the particles in the nucleus. So the neutron protons have a strong attraction for one another, and the protons just would not bind if you try to put two of them together.
And it's interesting that you don't need a negative charge to hold protons together.
Exactly.
A neutral element will do so.
Yeah, because this neutral element has another force besides the electric force that would cause the repulsion. We call it a strong force, and it's the force that holds nuclei together.
And how was that discovered?
Well, I guess at some level, it would go way back to early in the 20th century when Rutherford showed that the nucleus was really a very small thing and the electrons were orbiting around it. It was thought before that it was kind of a plum pudding with everything more or less on the same size scale. But what Rutherford's experiment showed was that the nucleus was concentrated, a very small, heavy thing in the center. And then you knew, well, gee, that's positively charged. Something has to be there holding it together. And if it's holding it together and it's very small, the thing holding it together has to be very strong.
Uh-huh. Now, the strong force, is it manifested anywhere besides nuclei?
This whole subject of what is sometimes called elementary particle physics, where one has found that the protons and neutrons are made up of things we call quarks. And it's in the quarks that you find the real origins of this strong force. Quarks interact by exchanging things we call gluons.
Okay, so hang on. We've got two big words that we don't know what they mean. Quarks. What is a quark?
A quark is a point-like particle, like an electron, except they have funny things. The charge on a thing we call the up quark is 2/3, and it's positive. The charge on the down quark is -1/3, and these objects combine together by gluon exchange to make neutrons and protons. And
now, hang on. What are gluons?
Oh, gluons are, this is where physics gets a little playful in the sense. Gluons are called, well, they're obviously called gluons, and the thing they exchange is a quantity we call color. So the subject is called quantum chromodynamics. And so there are three colors that the gluons come in, and actually there are, with the three colors you can make 8 possible combinations of, you know, red,
you're just
green.
Mapping onto the rainbow.
Well, at some level. Amusingly, when I was at Princeton, this was just about the time quantum chromodynamics was reaching the public press, a man who was a wallpaper hanger sent me a note saying that he had known this all his life, that color was the secret of the universe, and that finally we physicists had discovered it. So,
what did you think of that when you heard that?
I thought, well, I think this is very interesting, sir, and astute of you. However, to really understand all the manifestations of this quantum chromodynamics, you really would need to study some more physics.
So the gluons come in multiple colors.
Yes.
And what do they do in their capacity of, I mean, do you name the colors like red, orange, yellow, and so on?
Actually, it's red, green, and blue. And then the quarks are colored. So a blue quark could radiate a blue-green gluon over and change a green quark into a blue quark, and so on and so forth. But this quantum chromodynamics is just a way we have of keeping track of the possibilities of what can go on in these interactions. And it has one other really interesting property, in that the gluons can also interact with one another. And that accounts for some of the wonderful properties of QCD.
What does knowing about quarks and gluons help us to understand?
Well, first of all, it gave a solid physics underpinning to our understanding of the strong force. The strong force was very phenomenologically treated up to that point. There wasn't any really underlying theory that you could rely on.
So those particles are the theoretical basis of the strong force.
Yeah. And of course, one of the interesting properties of QCD is you could never see a quark. Everything you see in the world that we observe has to be colorless. So all this color dynamics is going on inside these particles, though none of this color, if you like, is leaking out.
So again, going back to our high school textbook, this little ball called a proton, it's not a ball.
Absolutely not.
What is it?
It's a vibrant, very, very active thing with lots of quarks and gluons running around. And as you probe it harder and harder, you see that there's more and more underlying structure that's there, more quarks and gluons.
Is there a theoretical smallest possible indivisible particle?
Well, that's a profound question, and I'm not really the person best qualified to answer it, but you really run into trouble if you truly have point particles. So,
what kind of trouble?
Well, it becomes a singularity. I mean, you're just going into shorter and shorter distance, and there's nothing there, and so you're getting down to length scales that quantum mechanics blows up on you. So the most active work in theoretical physics probably over the last 30 years or so is working on a thing called string theory, where these very tiny things are not actually points. They're loops. And so you can see a loop has an extent, and then you can get the loop vibrating and shaking and doing different things. And so that's how you would account for having different kinds of particles. And so string theory is a very difficult subject.
And we're not going to go there right now.
No, we're not going to go there. I couldn't take you there.
Well, we are going to go to quantum mechanics.
Okay.
So where do we start in terms of the particles that we've talked about so far in understanding quantum mechanics?
Okay. Well, one of the things that would immediately occur to you when you go back to that picture that you remember from your high school text is there's an awful lot of space between that electron and the proton.
Right.
And because they have opposite charges, you would think they attract one another. So,
I mean, there's a lot of space. I mean, if you were to blow them up to scale, I'm a little proton standing in the Santa Fe Baking Company, and you're an electron, what, halfway to Tsuki or something?
Oh, let's see. And where are you? You're here in Santa Fe Baking Company?
Yeah.
And how big are you?
Oh, okay. I'm the size of a ping pong ball.
The size of a ping pong ball. So that's
Which, of
like
course, is what protons look like.
Yeah. So that's about an inch, and so you're the order of 100,000 inches. So you're several miles away.
Okay, yeah. So that's another thing, a ping pong ball proton and its point-sized electron are really far away from each other.
Far away from each other.
So that's step one to understanding, to going into quantum mechanics.
Yeah, that's one thing to understand. And then the next thing is you say, well, their charges are opposite. So I thought they wanted to get together. So why can't you squeeze them apart? And the answer is to be found in quantum mechanics, because that electron is actually a wave, and the wave has the property that as you squeeze it, that is, you make the intervals that it goes up and down get closer and closer together, its energy goes up very, very quickly. And so the size of the proton is really set by how nicely you can get a wave that describes the electron to fit in the attractive field of the proton.
I thought you said it was a point a few minutes ago. Now it's a wave.
Yeah. Well, that's what we call a particle-wave duality, that when you start to get to very small energies, such as would be typical of binding of an electron in hydrogen, or to very short distances, you then see that particles actually demonstrate a wave-like behavior. And that was...
So they're orbiting very quickly in hydrogen around the little proton.
Yeah.
And they're orbiting in the formation of a wave, squiggling up and down
sine
wave?
No, you shouldn't think of it. You should think of it in terms of a wave, because the electron isn't really just running around in there. It's actually sort of fills that space. And that's just the size, that 10 to the minus 8 centimeters, is the size of the wavelength that you can fit in without increasing the energy so that hydrogen wouldn't be bound. You wouldn't have a hydrogen atom anymore.
Bound meaning the particles stick in a coherent unit.
Exactly.
So can you either draw it or make a movie of what it looks like if it's not... the ping pong ball with the little tiny balls around it?
Sure. I mean, it's a thing that's just moving very, very rapidly within that space, and you really can't localize it, you know, as a little point in there. It has a probability distribution, if you like, around that proton.
What does that mean?
Well, the most likely place to find it, if you could, is near the center of the proton. And then as you go further and further away, it gets less and less, you get less and less probable.
And then there's an outer limit beyond which it does not go.
Yeah, or we would prefer to say that the probability of it being out there is getting vanishingly small.
Okay. We're talking to Jerry Garvey, nuclear physicist at Los Alamos, and once again, he will be speaking tonight as part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science, Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. It's called How to Prove E equals MC squared to Your Mom and Dad. And you'll be able to do much more than that when we're done with you, or not. Okay, so what is a thumbnail definition of quantum physics? Like, what are we talking about compared to other kinds of physics? I mean, I guess, what are you looking at? I mean, in Newtonian physics, you're looking at things falling on the ground and...
So they're macroscopic phenomena that usually involve large objects. So if you, you know, computed the wavelength of one of these macroscopic objects, it would be so short as to be absolutely ridiculous with regard to the size of the object.
Right. So the wavelength really... when you're looking at a tennis ball, is not a factor. It's not an issue that you have to worry
exactly.
about.
Exactly. The wavelength of a tennis ball would be so extraordinarily small, it just doesn't make any sense.
But then when you're looking at atoms...
Yeah, you bet, which are small, then their wavelength scale gets appreciable to the extent of their physical size.
So what do you actually trying to measure, or what are the factors that it's looking at?
Okay, well, it helps you to, for example, understand things like the structure of atoms. One can, in a sense, reconstruct with considerable accuracy the whole of a periodic table, for example. You can even, as we get better and better, I'm not an expert at this, but people are able now to calculate chemical reactions, understand binding energies, what makes two atoms of a different type stick together and behave. One of the great successes of quantum mechanics, actually, now that I think of it, is to explain conductivity. Why do some things conduct electricity and others, you know, like copper and glass?
Right.
They're, you know, at some level, they're both hard, both solid, and yet they have an incredibly different behavior with regard to conducting electricity. And what happens is in copper, when you squeeze it together to make copper, some of the electrons get pushed out of being bound, and they're free to roam around inside the copper block, whereas in something like glass, conditions you find it at normally, all those electrons are bound closely to atoms, and so when you put a voltage across it, none of them are free to move, and so it's an insulator.
And so that's something that wasn't understood until people studied using the methods of quantum
mechanics. And then it became really relatively transparent.
So basically, the big difference we're talking about is that quantum physics is used to describe what's going on in very tiny spaces, which behave just differently than what is happening here in the baking company, where we're throwing cups in the air and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. When you get down to the scale where you have to resort to quantum mechanics, the world is really very different. And probably the place that, you know, we'll see that impact most directly will be in realizing what happens in nanotechnologies, where no longer will you have simple wires that you just put a voltage across and a current flows that you understand, but that small, very skinny connector now will be a thing where you have to worry about what are the quantum effects in that wire, and rather than having something like a whole transistor, you're going to have single atoms or single aggregate or simple aggregates of atoms carrying out certain functions. And again, you're going to have to understand those quantum mechanically.
And so it's a field with a lot of exploration going on all the time.
Oh, yeah. It is probably an extraordinarily important part of understanding all the electronics and lasers and various things like that that have a big effect in our economy.
Does the gravitational field apply at that small a scale?
No, it doesn't. Gravity is a very, very weak force, and you only see it really in some sense in the absence of the effects of the other forces. So the Earth and Sun are presumably neutrally charged, and the force that interacts, that acts on them, is just gravity. And there's certainly no quantum mechanics involved in understanding the motion of the Earth around the Sun. Similarly, I mean, things, massive objects that are held to the surface of the Earth by gravity, again, are things that quantum mechanics plays no role in. So I just talking off the top of my head, as far as I can see, for the most part, gravity is a non-quantum effect. It apparently is a difficulty in theoretical physics to get gravity and quantum mechanics together. So that's one of the frontiers of another theoretical physics frontier that people work on.
I can't help but noticing, I once tried to make a scale model of the solar system, and I ended up with a basketball in my kitchen and Pluto 2 miles away, or, or somewhere between a mile and 2 miles away. And there's a kind of analogy between and also in scale, between the proton and that electron a couple of miles away. Are there genuine, useful analogies between galactic scale and atomic scale? Or is that just like something that is kind of artistic, poetic imagination at work?
Well, what should I say? Yeah. I guess it is. It is that
there are poetic imagination.
Yeah, there are fundamental laws that apply at both scales: the conservation of momentum, conservation of angular momentum, the conserved quantities that we have in physics are for the most part conserved in quantum mechanics, and so. So there are certain carryovers, and in fact, much of quantum mechanics was formulated from a rather deep understanding of how you would formulate in a robust way classical mechanics.
You are at Los Alamos. What interest does a national laboratory have in studying these things, including and above and beyond blowing each other up?
Uh-huh. Well, it's a good idea to understand as much as you can. And it appears that the scale at which science, and in particularly physics, is evolving into requires very large undertakings. For example, we were talking earlier about that accelerator in Switzerland, the Large Hadron Collider. It's many, many miles in circumference, and costs the order of $10 billion to build, and operating it is very expensive. So you need large technically competent institutions to handle much of this kind of science. And
I mean, it's really just for its own sake? I mean, I know that a lot of science begins with an attempt to understand, and then eventually applications follow.
Right. But you never can tell what it is you need to know. I mean, in the most sinister sense, you could say you ought to know everything that your adversaries could possibly know. And by the way, was, you know, a bit of the thrust of the letter that Einstein wrote to Franklin Roosevelt in 1939, pointing out that there was this new nuclear kind of reaction that people had found out that they could possibly make into a chain reaction. And he had noted in the letter that apparently the Germans had at that time just conquered Czechoslovakia, and the Germans stopped selling uranium from Czechoslovakia when they took it over. So there were grounds to think that there were stuff you better learn, because it was potentially dangerous. So there's always, I think, some issue of national security. And, of course, the way the world is now, you need to learn these things just to keep your economy at the forefront. There's a lot of competition out there.
Right, right. Well, Gerald Garvey is a nuclear physicist at Los Alamos, former director of the Meson Physics Facility there. We look forward to seeing you.
Thanks a lot.